Romans 14. We're going to start with what people, Protestant Christianity, what do they say about Romans 14? If you present it to them or they present a situation where they're mentioning Romans 14, what exactly is it that they are saying it means? We're going to look at that, and I'm going to show you what the Protestant Christian scholarship of the 20th century said so that you can get a better feel for it. Then after we find out what they're saying, we're going to discuss the implications that that would present for Paul. The doctor. What does the doctor say about Romans 14? I have it. It's good. How many people have heard of the parable of the bread and the stone and the fish and the serpent? Okay, there's also an egg parable. I'm adding a new one. Yes, I know, Deuteronomy 4:2, so just bear with me. Then we have a section called It's All Greek to Me. That's for all you Greek lovers. Then we're going to go through the history of scholarly interpretation, and you're going to love it. The next meeting will be part two. We're going to look at the interpretational methodology of Protestant Christianity to understand how their minds think, because what you have to realize is that that's where the bulk of the people are who are coming into Hebrew roots are coming from over there, and we need to understand how they think. And since I'm a Southern Baptist, I'm a good candidate to tell you. Okay, if we're going to talk about Romans 14 and we're going to deal with food, you know we got to look at Mark 7:19. What is the weight of evidence? If you've been to the website, you know what it is. I'm going to put the weight of evidence on Mark 7:19, and then I'm going to break down 10 points that are going to lead to understanding what that passage really says. We're going to look at Mark 7 and the parallel passage in Mark 15. The reason that I'm doing this here is because there's been some request to learn how to study. How am I doing what I am doing? Because I haven't been sharing that. I've just been giving you the results. In part two, which will take place at our next Sabbath meeting, I'm going to break down how I'm getting from A to B to C to D. And this right here is how I'm going to connect those dots. So not only are you going to get the information, you're also going to find out how I got it. Then part three, one of the things that you'll learn when you look at the historical grammatical pursuit of understanding Scripture is that in the first century, purity was a major issue for Pharisees. We're going to discuss the purity issues of the first century and how Yeshua addressed them. If you're going to talk about food, who could leave out Paul, Peter in the sheet? And then the last one is 1 Timothy 4, because Hebrew Roots movement is being called a doctrine of devils. We need to dismiss that, and I'll show you how. Then we're going to discuss the history of Rome in 2 minutes, so it'll be concise. And then we will finish with Romans 14, and I will lay it out. All right, so that's what's coming up. Can never have a section of Scripture without having fun with math. And then I'll bring you the conclusions. Okay, so let's get started. What do they say it means? I just did this with a person on the phone, okay? They said, you shouldn't dispute about food or holy days. Well, how can you discuss something if you can't discuss something? Verse 14 is our killer verse. Nothing is unclean. Paul declared it. You're going to like that part too. And the third thing that they say is, now, remember, this is a Protestant Christian who has not come out of Protestant Christianity speaking to a Hebrew roots person saying, I'm strong and you're weak, and here's why. The major commentary of the 20th century for Protestant Christianity is called the International Critical Commentary, and we're going to look at some readings in here that deal with Romans so that you can find out how the minds have been set. As I go through this material, please remember, what is the plan of the enemy? What is the plan of the enemy? When I read this stuff, you're going to go, what? What? Remember the plan of the enemy. If you were the enemy, how would you do it? What I'm going to show you is that I actually have the scans. As you know, this PowerPoint's always available online, so if you need it, you can get it. I have all of this in PDFs. You send me an email, I send you the stuff. But I'm going to show you some pieces so that I can quote. This is the section that deals with, as you can see, Romans 14:1 at the top there, the strong and the weak. All right, and I'm going to pull some quotes out so that I can put you within the context of what Dr. Cranfield is talking about. Some recent commentators, this is Dr. Cranfield discussing other Protestant Christian scholarship. Some recent commentators have exhibited great confidence in their approach to the interpretation of this section. This we find surprising, for it seems to us to be extremely difficult to decide with certainty what exactly the problem is with which Paul is concerned in this section. My goodness gracious, somebody actually sees. Though some interpreters of the epistle seem to take it for granted that the nature of the problem is obvious, various suggestions regarding it have, as a matter of fact, been put forward. And there would seem to be, at any rate, six suggestions which must be considered. When I finish this presentation in August, I will present the seventh one. It is often assumed that the people referred to in this section as weak in faith, or simply weak, are people who are legalists. We've heard that term before. Legalists in the sense that they think to earn a status of righteousness before God by their own works. Remember, I'm quoting Dr. Cranfield. And imagine that their abstention from meat and wine and observance of special days constitute a claim on God. Now, I personally have never heard that before, but that's what he wrote. People who have not yet learned to accept justification as God's free gift. Then he quotes Dr. Barrett. Thus, Barrett holds that the weakness to which this passage refers attests a failure to grasp the fundamental principle which page after page of the Epistle of Romans emphasizes, that men are justified and reconciled to God by faith alone, or better, by God's own free electing grace. End of quote. I want to show you some scriptures. When I read this, when I read Cranfield's commentary, because I read several, I wanted to see what they were thinking, and I thought this was the best representative to present. The first thing that came to me was James. So what I want to do is I want to establish how we understand the scriptures so that we can demonstrate that what they're saying about us is not true. So I'm going to start with James chapter 2. We all know who James is, and I'll talk more about him as we go through here. What does it profit, my brethren, though a man say he hath faith and have not works? Can faith save him? That's the KJV rendering. I will now give you my rendering. What does it profit, my brethren, if a man keeps on saying he has faith, but keeps on not having works? Can that faith save him? The reason I rephrase it that way is because I took it straight out of the Greek and did a literal translation, not trying to make the English look pretty. That's what the literal Greek says. The leading Greek scholar of Protestant Christianity for the late 19th and most of the 20th century is A.T. Robinson. And he has created online for free, anybody who wants to download it online can, it's called Word Pictures of the New Testament, where he discusses almost all of the verses that exist. And so, because he's the leading scholar of Greek Christianity, I'm going to tell you what he says about James. What doth it profit is a rhetorical question, expecting a no answer. But keeps on not having works, it is the spurious claim to faith that James here condemns. How many remember that Martin Luther had a problem with James and didn't want to include it in the canon? Because of statements like this. But if you look at what the Greek is saying, and yes, I know that Luther was working in German, but he took it from the Greek. We'll discuss that later. It's understanding what James is going after, and we're going to really get into it. Can that faith save him? Negative answer expected. Let's go back to the verse. Now we move to verse 17. Faith, if it hath not works, is dead. And my expansion, even so, faith, if it keeps on not having works, is dead itself. Once again, expanded Greek. Continuing to the next verse. Yea, a man may say, thou hast faith, and I have works. Show me thy faith without thy works, and I will show thee my faith by my works. Once again, expanded from the Greek. Someone will say, hast thou faith? I have works also. Show me thy faith apart from thy works, and I, by my works, will show thee my faith. Now, this is word pictures. Look at what Dr. Robinson says. Yea, a man will say, James introduces an imaginary objector who speaks one sentence. Thou hast faith, and I have works. The objector can be regarded as asking a short question. Do you have faith? And the answer is, I have faith and I got works. James replies, I have works also. I hate getting ahead of myself. Show me thy faith apart from thy works. The reason I use the word apart is because of the Greek word there, which I have in brackets in yellow. It does not mean without. It means set aside. It's apart from. It's not without, as of non-existence. Show me thy faith apart from thy works. This is the reply of James to the objector, according to Dr. Robinson. The point lies in the word apart, which means not without, but apart from. That is, the works that properly belong to it and should characterize it. According to Dr. Robinson, it is not faith or works, but proof of real faith. Now, is this not where we are? This is how we understand it. It's not an issue of works or faith. It's living faith produces works. So what Dr. Robinson is saying here, yes, Protestant Christian, Greek scholar, he is saying it's not about faith or works, but it's proof of real faith. Good insight, Dr. Robinson. Continuing with the verses. Now we get into what does the word believe mean? Faith. Thou believest that there's one God. Irrelevant. The devils also believe and tremble. It does not benefit them that they believe there's one God. James goes on with his reply. Dr. Robinson, belief that God exists is not belief or trust in God. That's pretty important. Pretty important. Thou doest well. Dr. Robinson states, that is good as far as it goes, which is not far. Because it doesn't. We know how the demons are, you know, how they're doing right now. The demons also believe. They go that far. They never doubt the fact of God's existence, unlike some people in the world today who doubt the fact of God's existence. The demons are even beyond them, except it does not matter. Verse 20, but wilt thou know, O vain man, that faith without works is dead? KJV, my expansion. But thou dost thou wish to know, you man, you empty vessel, this is Greek literal, faith apart from works is worthless. That's where we are. I mean, isn't this how we understand what James is saying? It's not about works or faith. 24, I tell you what, James is a man who is going to reiterate. He did not read the book, How to Talk Unclear, okay? You see then how that by works a man is justified and not by faith only. This was Luther's most unfavorite passage. My expansion. You see then how that by works a man is shown to be righteous, not only by faith. Dr. Robinson is justified here, not is made righteous. Very important point. It's not is made righteous, but is shown to be righteous. Big difference. James is discussing the proof of faith, not the initial act of being set right with God. Big difference. He continues, and not only by faith. This phrase clears up the meaning of James. Faith, that is, live faith, living faith, is what we must all have. Only it must show itself also in deeds as Abraham's did. Why Abraham? Because a couple of verses earlier, he gives an example from the Torah about Abraham and how his deeds demonstrated his faith. And so that's he's drawing on a historical reference. That's usually a good thing. 26, James is not through pounding this rock. For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. I also translated this from the Greek, and it was really cool. For as the body apart from breath is dead, so faith apart from works is also dead. The Greek word was the medical term that was used in the first century when they would take some type of plate, mirror, glass, reflective surface, and put it up to the person's nose and mouth to see if they could see the impression of breath. And if it was not there, here's the word. And that was, you know, that was like, oh yeah, that nails it. Everybody knew what that meant in the first century. Okay, back to Dr. Robinson. Apart from the Spirit. apart from breath, he says. It is not easy to tell when one is dead, but the absence of a sign of breath on a glass before the mouth and nose is proof of death. Startling picture of dead... When I read this, I almost fell out of my chair. I got one later on where I did fall out, but this is pretty good. This is Dr. Robinson. Startling picture of dead faith in our churches and church members with only a name to live. They're called Christians. That's all they got. This is his assessment of the reality of Protestant Christianity in the 20th century. Ouch! Mm-mm-mm. All right, so just in case there's any question about who is James, he was the head of the Jerusalem Assembly. Yaakov was the official name. We will not discuss why he's called James in the KJV. 1:1, author of the epistle written to the 12 tribes scattered abroad, which are of the dispersion. I wonder who that could be. Verse 21, he says, receive with meekness the implanted, and I put also inborn because of the Greek word. I did some looking up on that. It's put within. Receive with meekness the put within word, which is able to bring about your actual salvation. That's based on Greek. And I put Jeremiah 31 because, as we all know, it is the writing on the heart of the character of God, which we've already gone over numerous times. 1:22, keep on becoming doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. This is James talking. For if any be a hearer of the word only and not a doer, which equals no works, he's like a man who looks into a mirror. This is a straight Greek translation because the English was not quite what I wanted in the KJV. He glances at himself in the mirror and off he goes, straightway forgetting what manner of man he was. And I can just imagine you walk up to a mirror, you see how you look, you immediately leave. You don't even concern. Now, this is talking about more than just physical appearance, but he's using that kind of like a metaphor, figure speech type thing. 25, here's the big one. He who looks carefully into the perfect law of liberty. Well, what is the perfect law of liberty? According to Protestant Christianity, it's the gospel of Christ, which is defined by Protestant Christianity as belief that he is the Son of God who came to redeem us, and that's it. That's a problem. Not according to James, and I'm going to show you why. He who looks carefully into the perfect law of liberty and continues therein, having become not a hearer that forgetteth, but a doer marked by works, in his doing this man shall be blessed. Now, if you think about it, this wording here, you know, what does this mean in relationship to the message of the gospel? Just, Jesus is Lord, I'm good to go. This doesn't really fit that very well. You know, it's a little disjointed, like that, what is it, square peg, round hole thing? You know, with the right tools, you can make it fit. But all right, let's take an excursion to the Vav of Psalm 119. Where is liberty associated? Take not the word of truth utterly out of my mouth, for I have hoped in thy judgments. So shall I keep thy Torah continually into perpetuity. I translated this from the Hebrew, so if your version says something different, understand. And I will walk at liberty, for I seek thy precepts. We got judgments, we got precepts, we got the Torah going on for a long time. I will speak of thy testimonies and will not be ashamed. I will delight myself in thy commandments, which I have loved. My hands also where I lift unto thy commandments, which I have loved, and I will meditate in thy statutes. He didn't leave nothing out. He's got the whole package here, right in the Vav. That's where liberty's found in the Torah. While head of the Jerusalem Assembly, he decreed the final decision in Acts 15 that the new incoming Gentiles need to adhere to the same Levitical commandments that Moses required the new incoming Gentiles back in the wilderness. We already covered that earlier. But this was his ruling. After you see Peter and whoever else spoke, James says, I make this decision, blah, 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 blah. And here's why. Okay, moving in time from Acts 15 to Acts 21, he met Paul when he arrived in Jerusalem. What was his lifestyle? What does Acts 21 say? He goes to Paul. Oh, I'm probably getting ahead of myself. Let me see if I have it here. Yes, here we are. Verse 20. Do you see, Brother Paul, how many tens of thousands of Jews there are which believe, and they are all zealous for the law? This is the James that was talking about works, faith, dead faith, law of liberty. What might he have been referring to? Just a guess here, just a guess. What does he tell Paul? Take the men, purify yourself, pay their expenses. Then all may know that you are not teaching apostasy. That's what he says. If you do this, everybody will know that you are not teaching apostasy. What is apostasy? As regards the teaching of Moses, it means not to observe Moses. This is what was the arrangement between James, the head of the mother church that we just read in chapter 1 and chapter 2. This is what was established when he discussed with Paul. And that, you know, we'll get into Paul keeping the law later. Conclusion on James. He was the head over all the churches. He set down church policy. Acts 15 was big. He was proud of the number of Jewish believers and their zeal for keeping Torah. You're going to see why that's important in a second. He counted himself in that group. He invited Paul to take specific actions so that he could know once and for all if Paul should also be counted in that group. It was very clear. Now, let's go back to James chapter 1, verse 25. But he who looked carefully into the perfect law of liberty, what do you think it is? If the Torah is the perfect law of liberty, what are the works he refers to in the faith apart from works section? Probably has something to do with the Torah. Just a guess. The word inborn statement at 121, which I spoke about previously, speaks to the works that properly belong to faith and should characterize it. That is Dr. Robinson, the Protestant Christian scholar. Yeah, the works that properly belong to faith and should characterize it. Amazing. It is not faith or works, but proof of real faith, which equals observance of Torah from the heart. Is any of this new? Have we not been finding this in every section we have looked at on the path this year? All right, let's go back to the International Critical Commentary. I'm continuing to post the pages for anybody who wants to track this down later. It's often assumed that the people referred to in this section as weak in faith, or simply weak, are people who are legalists in the sense that they think to earn a status of righteousness before God by their own works. No, that's not what James is saying. We just saw it. He's not even near that. Dr. Robinson isn't even near that. They imagine, you've already read this, imagine that their abstention from meat and wine and observance of special days constitute a claim on God. People who have not yet learned to accept justification as God's free gift. Have we been nailed incorrectly or what? This is not right. Thus, Barrett holds that the weakness to which this passage refers attests a failure to grasp the fundamental principle which page after page of Romans emphasizes, that men are justified and reconciled to God by faith alone, or better, by God's own free electing grace. We're not arguing with you. But James says if you don't have works that are a part of a living faith, your faith is not going to do much for you. So we're not in disagreement with them. We just got to get over this hump. All right, let's continue moving now. As I told you in the beginning of this, Dr. Cranefield identified six major ones. I'll add a seventh later. But the sixth one, the 2 through 5, we're not even going to spend time there. Okay, they're just, they have no merit. But the sixth one is worth looking at because I think you're going to be appalled. Here we go. A sixth possibility is that the weakness of the weak consisted in a continuing concern with literal obedience of the ceremonial part of the Old Testament. But what does ceremonial mean? Their definition of ceremonial was the Sabbath, feast days, clean and unclean, sacrifices, and discharging vows. Ooh-ooh.
Now we have a problem.
The weak felt, the weak felt they could not, with a clear conscience, give up the observance of such requirements of the law as the distinction between clean and unclean foods, the avoidance of blood, excuse me, anybody read Acts 15 recently? The keeping of the Sabbath and other special days. The weak. Top line, the weak. Who's in this group? Who do we know in the first century who observed the Torah, the Sabbath, some of the feast days, clean and unclean, and avoided blood in food? Well, let's go to blood. Let's just take blood for 100, okay? What do we got? We got James. We got the apostles, Peter and Paul. This is straight out of 15. We got the elders of the assembly. We got the people in the assembly. And through the testimony of the Spirit of holiness, the Almighty Himself. Wow. Those are the weak. I think I'll join them. I put down this reference because when you look at the PowerPoint, you need to know what concord is. If you read the 1530, right before the Protestant Reformation, there, and this is on the website, there's a link straight there. I think it's number 62. It'll take you to a section where it says that, and this thing about blood in Acts 15, nobody observes that. And if they did, it's okay, you don't have to observe it. Because the disciples, they didn't want to have to observe that either, but they did for a while just to make everybody happy. That's what they said. I'm like, I brought this up to some people. I said, who are you to just do away with the commandments because I decided to? I didn't know that. Ready? Remember the weak now. The weak in faith are also character-wise by a certain weakness of character. Remember, we're talking about James, the elders of the church in Jerusalem, Peter and Paul, a liability to yield to social pressure and allow themselves to be blown off the course which their own faith has set them free. The attachment to the festivals, new moons, and Sabbaths, clean and unclean, and no blood and food, is a feeling which, while it goes very deep, is ill-defined and difficult to defend by argument. Well, yeah, if you don't have the Old Testament, you could have some struggles. It accords, too, with what is said about the grief, the spiritual ruin, to which the weak, that's James and the other observers of Torah, can easily be brought to. For to have a deeply felt conviction, but to be unable to marshal clear-cut arguments in its defense, is to be in very serious danger of losing one's personal integrity. Oh, Paul, I feel bad for you. The weak were abstaining from meat and observing the feast days because they felt sincerely, albeit mistakenly, that it was only along this particular path that they could obediently express their response of faith to God's grace in Christ. I feel like sometimes they're so close. So close. I could reword this sentence and not add any words. I could take away a few, but I could reword the sentence and make it correct. I mean, that's how close they are. The mention of... This is standard protocol. The mention of abstinence from wine is not so easily accommodated in this framework. This whole framework he just established of why we're the weak, the mention of abstention from wine is not so easily accommodated. Perhaps the reference should be understood as hypothetical and didn't really exist. Then we don't have to deal with it. Help me. All right. Conclusion. The most probable explanation of the nature of the disagreement, now this is straight out of Cranfield, between the weak and the strong is that, whereas the strong had recognized that Yeshua is the goal and substance and innermost meaning of the Old Testament law has come, the festivals, new moons, Sabbaths, clean and unclean, no blood, no longer required to be literally obeyed. On the other hand, the weak felt strongly that a continuing concern with literal observance of the ceremonial law was an integral element of their response of faith to Christ. Has he nailed it on the head? Yes! You got it! You got it! Amen! Hallelujah! So, I ask you again, what are we up against? Do you really want to know? This is what we're dealing with. All right, going back to the beginning. Don't dispute about food and holy days. Nothing's unclean. I'm strong and you're weak because you want to continue to observe God's righteous standard where I've been set free from it. All right, this is what we have to deal with. Let's continue. All right, implications for Paul. Acts 21, we just looked at that. They've been informed that you're apostatizing from Moses. If you will do this, they will know that there's nothing to these accusations and that you yourself also observe the ceremonial law as Protestant Christians will define it in the future. There it is, right there. Paul's conscience. I've actually read commentaries in which people said, you know, I don't know how Paul could have said that. I mean, he's teaching people not to keep the law, and he's lying to James right to his face. And I'm thinking, have you ever considered that might not be the case? All right, here's some conscience quotes. Paul, earnestly beholding the council, said, "Men and brethren, I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day." Either he is the greatest liar of all time, or perhaps he's telling the truth. "Herein do I exercise myself to always have a conscience void of offense toward God and toward men, but have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. Now the end of the commandment is a good conscience, holding faith and a good conscience, whom I serve from my forefathers with a pure conscience." I think that's enough. What do we think? Paul knows something about conscience. All right, conclusion. Paul is weak and strong at the same time, according to Romans 15:1. Because he observes the ceremonial law in 14, that makes him weak. But in 15:1, he says, "I'm strong." So Paul is strong and weak. I'm looking for the commentary that's going to address that. Paul teaches Colossae Gentiles to keep the ceremonial law. We saw that when we studied Colossians 2, 16 and 17. We broke that down. Paul supports James, the elders, the other apostles, the whole church, and the Most High in the blood restriction in Acts 15. Paul is there. He's included in it. So how can you? I don't even know how they could. And for those people who want to know more about Paul, here was an excellent book, Paul, a Middle of the Road Christian. It actually exists. I love this stuff. Okay, what does the doctor say? When Protestant Christianity reads Romans 14, yes, 5 and 6 talks about days, but the rest of the chapter talks about food. So they feel like really the weight of the chapter is about food. And you know what kind of food it is, the stuff that's not food. So I've been following this professor, and I just want to share a little teeny clip. He's the biology professor of biological sciences at the University of Southern California. He's also appeared on the History Channel, and he had a clip about shellfish that I thought was good. What he's going to discuss here is about water and toxins in the water and how shellfish are part of the ecosystem. He's going to discuss three types of poisoning that are available for us when we consume shellfish. They are amnesic, paralytic, and neurological. Okay, here we go. Continuing, we discuss these parables. What man is there of you whom if his son asks for bread, will give him a stone? We've heard that before. Bread, stone, different. Asks for a fish, gives him a serpent. And asks for an egg, gets a scorpion. Okay, I submit another one. If he asks for food, will he give him poison? That's a question in my mind. It's all Greek to me. Here is the word for clean. I want you to notice it very clearly. K-A-T-H-A-R-T-O-U. Now I'm going to show you the word for unclean. It's the exact same spelling, except it has the word A, the letter A in front of it. That's how you do the opposite in Greek, is you place the A in front. So as you can see, these words are pretty close. And if you had a bad manuscript, you might, you know, you can mess up something. The A was kind of like lost, ink wore off, you know, something like that. But now, what is the word for common? Oh, yeah, that looks exactly the same. I mean, do we have a mystery here? I don't think so. Clean, unclean, common. There is no debate that clean and unclean ain't even close to common. See what I'm saying? Completely different set of letters, K-O-I-N-O-N. Up there, you got K-A-T-H-A-R-T-O-U, Completely different set of characters. There is no confusion here. So that you can see this in action, I'm going to give you Peter with the sheet. And almost every version that I have read has verse 14 correct. It says, I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. Let's look at the Greek. K-O-I-N-O-N. The word for an is K-A-I. The next word is A-K-A-T-H-A-R-T-O-N. Common and unclean. You can see the words are different. So they know what the words are when we're talking common and unclean. There's no question in the Greek that these words are not even close. And they get it right in verse 14 all the time. They get it right. Here is the fun part. If we're going to address Romans 14, we have to know the history of how it was understood. Because today, do you have your Aramaic Bible? Yes. Pull up Romans 14. They got it wrong. Every New Testament after 1611, every translation that exists except for the ISR has it incorrect, and I'm going to show it to you. But prior to the KJV in 1611, all but one of them had it correct. So what has happened here? Oh, I haven't even seen it. That must not be in my Bible works. Okay, sorry. So now we got two. All right, here we go. I looked at the New King James. We're going to look at Bible versions from 1370 to 1966. Here we go. Oh, this is where my library, they have a rare book display. You go in, they put white gloves on you, you go in the room, they open up the books. I was looking at books that were dated back into the 1400s with my camera. So I just wanted you to show that. We're going to start with Dr. Wycliffe in 1370. Here is a picture of the book of Romans. Here is verse 14 on the left side. I've highlighted it. It says unclean, unclean, and unclean. This is Middle English. Where did Wycliffe get this from? He did not have any Greek manuscripts. He took this out of the Vulgate. He took it out of the Latin. So he got it wrong. Now, I tried to get a Latin version that was before 1380. I have not been able to secure that yet. Probably had to go to the Library of Congress to get that. But anyway, starting with Wycliffe, I don't count him because he was using the Vulgate, had no Greek documents. He's got unclean. I have it underlined in blue. It occurs three times. Okay, next is John Huss. John Huss was a follower of Wycliffe, and in 1415, you have to understand that back then, the law said if you were found with a manuscript of the Bible or the New Testament or a portion of the New Testament that was not in Latin, you would be put to death. That was the law. Most of the time, it was crucifixion accompanied with burning. Every once in a while, they would attach stuff to your different limbs and pull them apart and drag you through the street, but not always. But in the end, you were dead. So he was one of the ones that was put to death. And the way they put him to death, they put him on a stake, and then they used Wycliffe's translation into Middle English to fuel the fire. Okay. But he had this tremendous quote. Look at this. Oh, this is the fella. This is what he looks like. Here's the quote. In 100 years, God will raise up a man whose calls for reform cannot be suppressed. Martin Luther. Amazing. Thomas Linacre in 1490. This is the quote in which I fell out of my chair. This is what he looks like. Here's the quote. Either this is not the gospel or we are not Christians. Let me tell you what happened. He, like Dr. Wycliffe, were professors at Oxford. So they knew languages. So Wycliffe was unable to get a hold of any Greek in the late 14th century. He wrote in like 1382, 1380, 1370, sometime in this. But here you see we're at 1490. We've moved a whole century ahead. Even here, the printing press has already come into existence, maybe 1440, 1450, don't know exact date. He got a hold of some Greek manuscripts, and he read the New Testament in Greek. And after reading the New Testament in Greek and knowing the Latin Vulgate, he said, either this is not the gospel or we are not Christians. Here's how it breaks down. Either the Greek New Testament that I have acquired is not the gospel since we're following the Latin Vulgate New Testament, or in following the Latin Vulgate, we're not even Christians. What a major statement. Okay, Colette, 1496. Here's how he looks. Another professor. When he got a hold of the Greek, and he was able to preach in the church in English from the Greek. And this is the church, St. Paul's Cathedral, 20,000 people would come to service to hear it in Middle English, and 20,000 would be out the side trying to hear on every Sunday to listen to the Greek New Testament being taught in Middle English. Of course, right now they only have about 200 in each service, and most of them are visitors. But back then, people wanted to hear the word. It was Rasmus. I know I've badmouthed him from time to time, but today I have good things to say about him. Here is his New Testament parallel, Greek on the left side, Latin on the right side. Because what happened was, he was a devout Catholic. But he continued to tell the Catholic authorities that you've got some problems with the Vulgate. They would not listen. So he decided to circumvent them and translate a new Latin from the Greek New Testaments that he was able to acquire. So here's an example. And if you look on the left side, his Greek, look what it says, K-O-I-N-O-N. Three times he's got common. Look at the Latin. Common, common, common. So as you can see here, back this far, they have it correct. Let's move forward. Oh, he also wrote a separate Greek one, and you can see the words even better. K-O-I-N-O-N. All three times. Underlined in blue. Luther comes to him and says, yo, I need that Latin Greek parallel Bible you just wrote. So he wrote it. Look what he has. G-E-M-E-Y-N. Three times. What does that mean? Well, let's go over to Acts. This is Peter 10:14. Nothing is common, unclean. Look at the difference in the spelling. It's the same one for common. So Luther had it right in 1522 in German. The Latin had it right. The Greek had it right in 1519. Coverdale Bible in 1535. Here's what it looks like. They started to dress them up a little bit back then. You can see chapter 14 over there. Here's the text. 1535, English, common, common, common. They all had it correct. Matthew, this is the Matthew Tyndale Bible of 1535. Most of us have heard of Tyndale. Here is chapter 14, and here's the passage. Verse 14, common, common, no unclean. Matthew Tyndale Bible has it correct. The Great Bible of 1539, common, common, common. They have it correct. The Geneva Bible, when they got a whole bunch of new scholars together, and you know what that's going to do. Here's Romans 14, unclean, unclean, unclean. This is the only time they got it wrong. So what did they do? Oh, just so you know about unclean, I put in Acts 10:14. Look up there. Common or unclean? You can see unclean spelled in the Middle English there. Look to the left of that. You see polluted. Then you see the double parallel lines to the left of that, which is the way they refer you to the column over there, and you can see the word common. They knew what it was and still put it in wrong. That's knowingly and willingly. All right, let's continue. The Bishop Bible, how did this come into existence? They had to correct the Geneva Bible. Did they get it right? Common and common. The KJV 1611. What do they got? Unclean, unclean. Look at the little cross to the left of it. In the column, Greek, common. Now, here's what happens. You can do a footnote, and in this side, I guess you'd call it a column note. You can do that. But if you take away the column, we don't know what's happening. You take away the footnote of your change from what the text says. We don't know what's going on. Maybe we don't have access to the Greek New Testament. So we're depending on you to get this right. There's your problem. Reims is 1861. What happened was is that the Catholics realized that they could not suppress people desiring to hear the scriptures in their own tongue, so they rewrote the Latin Vulgate in English here. Believe it or not, they got it right. However, when you read the updated version, common, 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 but over on their column, they say common. That is unclean. Help me. To finish this off, I've got the Greek New Testament from 1966, which I have, and here it is, K-O-I-N-O-N. So you can see that prior to today, prior to the KJV, with the exception of the modern and the ISR, everybody has it wrong. But prior to the 1611, everybody but Geneva, we don't count Wycliffe, had it right. What is that called? That is a problem. All right, my summary. We don't count Wycliffe because he only had the Latin Vulgate. I have not been able to authenticate the Vulgate from the 1370 to find out what it said, so we're letting him slide. Lanier in 1490, Colet, Erasmus had it right both in the Latin and the Greek. Luther translated it correctly in the German. Coverdale's Bible had it correct. Matthew Tyndale had it correct. The Great Bible had it correct. Geneva, who knows? The bishop corrected to Geneva. The KJV had the column. The Rhymes had it correct. And the Greek New Testament today has it correct. But every translation has it wrong. So what are we facing when they come to us with food issues out of Romans 14? Nothing's unclean. This is what we're facing. A conspiracy to not tell the truth. That's an issue. Can't miss it. Can't miss it. I have stats and other stuff, too, I won't even do today, that go through the New Testament, go through the Septuagint, break down the use of common, unclean, clean, show all the passages. I also have the rabbinic readings on it. I've looked at Philo and Josephus, and it is unequivocally clear. Everybody knew there was a difference, and everybody today is choosing to ignore it. For me, that's a problem. So that's my summary. That's all I have. If you have questions, this is snack time. Come up and see me. I just wanted to establish a foundation that you know when I tell you the passage means common and not unclean, I want you to realize that throughout history, they all knew what it was and most of them got it right. But today, something else is afoot. That's what I want you to know. Thank you.